For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Let's just take a look at your passage here. Colossians 3, 18 and 19 says, "Wives, be subject to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be embittered against them." So we're in the practical section of Colossians, where he's giving advice, and he gets to this section on marriage. And so what I'm going to focus on in marriage is the idea of conflict and conflict resolution. I think that is faithful to the passage. If you look a few verses before this, he tells them, forgive one another if any of you has a grievance against someone. He's talking about conflict. Verse 15, let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, since as members of one body you were called to peace. So he's talking about unity here, being a unified group of people, and then he jumps into marriage. So we're going to be thinking about conflict resolution in marriage. And now, although I have some of the gray hairs poking through my beard and my hairline is receding a little more each day, believe it or not, I've only been married for 7 years. And some of you guys might be thinking, oh, who is this young chump getting up here thinking he's telling me about marriage? Well, like Tom. Well, I got 2 points to say to you. And point number one is right here. That's the stage of life I'm in right now. Those are the three beautiful women that the Lord has entrusted to me. And many of you have been in this stage, and you know that this is exciting and fun and crazy and memorable and hilarious and extremely challenging. And my wife and I have had more conflict in the last couple years than we've had throughout our whole relationship combined before that. So I think I'm learning some things that I'd like to share with you. I know I'm still learning. I'm in the midst of that. But it's fresh on my mind. So I got a lot of thoughts here on this. Secondly, my other point is that what's cool about teaching the Bible is that it's not about the teacher's adequacy or qualifications. It's about what God has to say here. And I believe, he says, my word, when it goes forth, will not come back to me without accomplishing what I have in mind. And I believe that could happen today if you're willing. So I really do believe that everybody here, God has some thoughts for you that he wants you to take with you. I think this is going to be really practical stuff, you'll see. And if you're willing to humble yourself, I think that God's got some thoughts for you here. And that brings me to one other thing I want to say before we get started here is that for anybody that's here this morning and you're single, this is just basic conflict resolution principles. So this could apply to any relationship, your boss, your roommate, your best friend. These are basic principles about conflict resolution. I'm going to be thinking about it in terms of marriage, but I just want you to take whatever I say and apply it to your friendships. It's not bad for you to learn this stuff now anyway and save you years of difficult marriage. Learn how to have conflict resolution now. In any of your relationships now as a single person, you have a much easier escape pattern, right? You get to go home at night. You get to run from that if you want. When you get into marriage, you don't get to do that. So focus here and think about this, and I think there's things for you too. And the other person I want to talk to tonight, I know that some of us here are probably divorced. And I'll tell you, some of the things you're going to hear are probably going to bring up bad memories of conflicts you've had. There's going to be times where you feel hopeless as you hear this. And I just want to say right off the bat, we serve a God of grace. He's the God of second chances, third chances, fourth chances, fifth chances. And he still wants you to have an abundant, fruitful, joyful life, whether in marriage or not. And I want to say that right up front here, just to get us in the right perspective. Okay, so with that in mind, I want to start here. Conflict can and should be healthy. For some of you this morning, this is the best news you're going to hear the whole morning. It's like, yeah, I get a lot of conflict. That's good, right? Well, it can be. It's supposed to be healthy. So that is good news. First of all, conflict helps determine what is right. Without conflict, the most opinionated person wins. The loudest mouth gets to say what happens. And once there's conflict and you can discuss through something, you can get to truth, which should be the goal. That's what we're trying to find. So conflict is good. We need conflict so we can find out what's right. Conflict is a way to learn about yourself. As Brad Pitt says in Fight Club, how much can you really know about yourself if you've never been in a fight? When you get into arguments, when you get into fights, this is where you find out, what are you really passionate about? What really drives you? What is worth having an argument about? So you're going to learn a lot about yourself through conflict. And that's a good thing. Conflict is a way to see God work. It might not feel that way in the moment. I'm sure some of us in this room are probably in ongoing conflict right now, and you're thinking, no, this isn't true. I just wish it was done. But I bet you could also look back and think of times we've been in conflict in the past and how much God taught you through that about yourself, about Him. And it's awesome usually later to look back and see God was really at work here. And so in the midst of it, it takes faith. But afterward, we can look back and see, man, it did yield some results. And finally, the opposite here. Lack of any conflict is a bad sign. What would it say if I could get passionate and heated up and angry about the Buckeyes losing a football game and I haven't had a fight with my wife in months? I think that would be a bad sign. Lack of any conflict is usually a bad sign. Now, this brings me to my next point. We've all been made differently, and conflict's going to look different in different marriages. And so you don't determine if a marriage is good or bad based on how much conflict there is or how loud the conflict it is, because it's different for everyone. It's how you deal with and resolve that conflict that you want to look at. The way Ken Sandy talks about it in his book, The Peacemaker, he says there's two types of people. There's the peace faker who tries to avoid conflict. That's probably most of us. When there's a difficult conversation to be had, we look for any way out of it possible, okay? And then there's the opposite. There's the peace breaker who actively seeks after conflict. Here's a little visual image for you. This is from the movie Mean Girls. It came out about a decade ago, if anybody's seen this. There's a guy on the left, right? He's the ultimate peace faker, just trying to keep everyone happy. And then you've got Rachel McAdams, which is one of the great peace breakers in movie history. She is just looking for a fight wherever she can have it. And so, if you have two peace fakers get married to each other who are that way by nature, that's just kind of the way they're built, there's not going to be a ton of conflict. Maybe there's some of you that can never think of a time where you've had a shouting match with your spouse. Doesn't mean you have bad marriage or necessarily a good marriage. Likewise, you get two peace breakers to get married, you're going to want to get out of the room when they're about to go at it, because there's going to be some yelling. And that's just by nature the way they're made. So we're going to talk through resolving conflict, which is what we want to see. Of course, the ideal, what we're shooting for, is the peacemaker. Nobody is this way naturally, but this is what we're shooting for. So as I'm talking this morning, I want you to think about leaning against your tendency, okay? So, you know, when I'm talking about overlooking conflict, if you're a peace faker, I don't want to hear you like, yeah, see, you don't need to get in conflict. No, that's what you do naturally. Let's challenge ourselves and try to think about the opposite way you would naturally respond there, because you probably need challenge in this area. So that's different ways people respond to conflict. Now, here's the question we want to think about for a little bit. Should I enter into conflict? You've got some situation that came up, some conversation is happening, and you're asking this question. This implies that conflict is a decision, not just a reaction. It ought to be. We should be thinking, should I enter into conflict? So that takes me stepping away for a little bit and asking some questions, okay? And the first question, the most important question we should ask in wondering if we should enter conflict is this. Is this for the better interest of the other person? My first question is not, am I annoyed by this? Or even, was I hurt by this? But instead, is this for the better interest of the other person? You see, from the Christian perspective, God meets all our needs. My needs have all been met by God. So I don't need my spouse to treat me a certain way for me to have real joy and to be complete in my life. Because God's already done that. And so I can rest in God and only confront the other person when it's really hurting that other person. This is the biblical perspective. Let me lay out a few lines here from Larry Crabb. I think he does a good job of explaining this. He says, the radical premise of my argument is that we literally need nothing but the Lord and what he chooses to provide. It is, of course, legitimate to want another's love and to want it so much that its absence will occasion real grief and suffering. But I must never slip into assuming that I need that person's love in order to meet my basic need for security. If that assumption is true, then God is not at that moment meeting the needs of his child. Has God proven unfaithful? You see, of course, if I'm in a marriage that's a delicate relationship, I'm going to be hurt at times. I'm going to be saddened by the way my spouse treated me. But I can't get to that point where I think I need that person to treat me a certain way for me to be happy. Because if that's true, then God is not doing his job. God is the one to meet my needs. He goes on, he says, I literally need nothing other than what God allows me to have. Either God has failed me, or he hasn't. Either he is meeting my needs right now, or he isn't. Christianity demands that I trust God to be faithful. If I really did need that person's love, God would see to it that I had it. Well, as he states, this is a pretty radical premise here. He goes on to explain the two basic spiritual needs that every human being has is the need for security, some type of safety, peace, a lack of overwhelming anxiety, and significance, that I matter, that I'm important. Every human being has these two basic needs, and they've been placed there by God so that he can fill those needs. He placed them there so he can fill them in your life. And so, if you're looking to your spouse, or even your children, or your career, your money, to have your basic needs of security and significance met, it'll always fall short. You're never going to be filled in the way you're looking for because they're not meant to be filled by those things. They're meant to be filled by God who placed them there in the first place. What the beautiful message of Christianity. If you're here this morning and you're not a follower of Jesus Christ, this is the invitation. Maybe you've been looking to your spouse to meet your needs, and they're not loving you in the way you ought to be loved, and therefore you're not happy. They're unable to, and God is able to. What if that's true? What if today you could take up God's offer to meet your needs? He offers it freely. There's nothing you need to do on your part. Jesus Christ came and he lived a perfect life and died for our sins so that I can freely accept this. And I say, yes, God, I want that. I want you to come into my life and fill me. And then you will be able to have that joy and peace and your needs met without needing your spouse to meet them for you. Maybe that's the basic thing that some of us need to hear this morning, that invitation. If you are a Christian believer, then this is true of you, although you might forget that at times. Or maybe you didn't know, or maybe you're just currently not believing that. It is true of you that God has met your basic needs. And so you can love your spouse out of an abundance of what God has given to you and confront them, help them have conflict when it's better for them. You can look toward helping them have their needs met by the Lord too. If you feel like you've strayed from that, you've forgotten that, okay, let's get back into that. I think especially like if I'm going on a date with my wife, I want to have that in my mind. I want to have promises. Oh, this, by the way, this is by Larry Crabb, like I said here. I want to have promises like Philippians 4:19. My God will meet all your needs according to his glorious riches in Christ Jesus. God is rich. He's got the resources to do it. I want him to meet my needs. I'm going to remember that he's done that. And I can go into my date with my wife with that in mind. And I can give and I can look to her needs having met by God. So that's the first and most important question to ask. Is this really for the better of the other person? Second, we want to ask, is this a major issue? Ken Sandy, he says that 90% of the time we should overlook conflict. 90% of the conflict you get in, maybe you should have overlooked it and not actually had conflict about that. Is it a major issue? Look at what the Proverbs say. A fool shows his annoyance at once. You react, right? But a prudent man overlooks an insult. A man's wisdom gives him patience. It is to his glory to overlook an offense. So most of the time we ought to be overlooking. How do we do that? Okay, you want to take a step back when you're feeling this way and ask yourself, why am I so bothered by this? So he left the toilet seat up again. And you've asked him countless times not to do that. And so, what are you thinking? I need to go tell him again and confront him. We got to have an argument over this. I'm going to fight on this. Well, take a step back. Ask yourself, why am I so bothered by this? And we don't naturally do this. But if you rewind a little bit and dig a little deeper, this might be your thought process. Well, I asked him not to do it. He did it. That means he doesn't care about me. Is that true? No, that's not true. He simply forgot to put the toilet seat down. Just tap it down and move on with your day. Not a major issue. Besides, you have all your needs met by the Lord. You didn't need him to do that, right? So what you're doing here is you're trying to pick your battles. This is what you're trying to do. You're trying to pick your battles so that you have an audience when it is a major issue. If you're going to give him a hard time every time he leaves that half-open can of Pepsi lying around the living room, he's not going to know when it's a serious subject. I am terrible at this. I come home late at night. Right when I walk in the door, I notice that the basement light is on. My wife's upstairs. All right, so I go shut off the light. I'm walking upstairs, telling myself, not a big deal. Who cares? Don't say anything. Don't say anything. We start talking. Honey, you left the light on. Ah, oh, I said it again. Right? I wish I was better at this, but I don't. I've got to tell her. I don't know why. I just have to tell her that she shouldn't have done that. Or my wife will leave dishes lying around upstairs in the bedroom. And I got to gather all these dishes and take them down to the sink. Can I just do it and not say anything? Is that a major issue? Is that hard? Is that something I'll look back on 30 years from now and say, oh, my marriage could have been better if she took the dishes down? It's not a major issue. My wife's really good at this. Something that I do that bothers her, after I take a shower, I don't close the shower curtain. I don't know why she wants the shower curtain closed, but she does, and it bugs her. And she's told me that before, but I know I've done it many times, and she's just overlooked it and hasn't told me. She has an audience when there is something she wants to confront me on, because I know it's serious, it's major. When I make sandwiches on a counter, I always leave a bunch of crumbs there, I guess, and that bugs her like crazy. But rarely has she told me that. I know I've done it a lot of times because it's not a big deal, not a major issue. You got to pick your battles. Here's another question to ask yourself. Is this simply the way that God made him or her? This revolutionized my marriage. If I would have known this when I got married, I would have saved myself tons of unnecessary conflict. Why did I marry my wife? Okay, I married my wife because she is funny, she's spontaneous, she's gentle, warm, kind, she's the life of the party, everybody loves her, wants to be around her. Those are all things that are not true of me. And so I was attracted to that in her, and so, you know, that's what I was looking at. I was excited, I married her. Now, all through dating and engagement, I knew the other side of the coin. I knew that she was financially irresponsible, that she'd messed up in that area quite a bit. She was in quite a bit of debt when we got married. I knew that she wasn't known as being the clean roommate. She had a difficult time doing her chores, you know. I knew those things, but I wasn't thinking about that, right? I had my marriage goggles on, and I'm like, yeah, I want to marry this person for all the good things. And I hadn't even thought about the negative things. Or maybe, I guess, I assumed that when she married me, those things would just change. I am a fool because they didn't. Now, she has grown in those areas some, but she's never going to be like me in those areas. So why am I putting that expectation? That's not the way she was made. That's just not who she is. She's never going to be like me in those areas. So that was most of our conflict the first couple years, and it didn't do any good because she's still that same way. I've got to learn, look, if I didn't want to marry someone like that, I shouldn't have married that person. I married her for all those strengths I just said, and those are still true of her today, and I still love those about her. So I remind myself of those now when I'm annoyed by the other side, because that's just how, you get the good and the bad in marriage, okay? For me, she married me because I'm dependable. I'm a steady rock. You know what you're going to get. I'm consistent. But guess what? That means I'm also anal. I'm critical. I'm downright mean sometimes. And she gets both of those. And I think I'm growing in those areas, but I am never going to be thought of as the nice guy. That's just not me. But she likes those other characteristics. Okay, so think about that in your marriage. If most of your conflict is about something that you knew going into marriage she was this way or he was this way, then you are the fool that's fighting over these things because you knew it. So avoid that as the main area of conflict. It's just going to be there. Finally, should I enter conflict, you can always seek advice. Don't be like my seventh grade students where I teach that, who do they ask if they're wondering if someone is in the wrong? They ask their best friend. And of course, oh yeah, he was in the wrong. Yes, you're right. Don't be like that. The best person to ask would be your spouse's best friend. That's going to get you some truth, right? So go to your spouse's best friend. Hey, this is an issue I'm seeing in his life. Do you think this is worth bringing up? Does this seem like this would be worthy of really confronting him on, having a difficult conversation about? You might get some help there. So these are the type of things you should be thinking about should you enter conflict. As Ken Sandy says here, he says, Christians are the most forgiven people in the world, therefore we should be the most forgiving people in the world. Most of the time, we're going to overlook conflict. Maybe that's the best thing you're going to get out of this whole teaching, is that the amount of fights you have are just going to lessen because they were over stupid things to begin with. And you can have your needs met by the Lord and not have to fight over this. Now, if you've gone through that list and it's like, yep, we need to have some conflict. How do you do this? What do you do? Well, there's the preparation stage. And the preparation stage is basically one word, okay? You got to pray. You think you know you're going to have some difficult conversation? Some conflict's going to happen. It'd be a bad idea not to be praying about this. What do you pray for? What are the type of things you should be thinking about when you're praying? First of all, you want truth to win out over emotion. There's going to be emotion in conflict. This is a passionate subject. There's going to be emotions rising, sure. But ultimately, we want truth to win. I don't want us to go a certain direction in my marriage but just because I'm really angry and loud. I want to do what's right. And I think God can help that if I'm praying for that. Praying for the right perspective. Who is God and what is he doing in this, okay? God is in control. As it says in Proverbs 19, many are the plans in a man's heart, but it is the Lord's purpose that prevails. You might be really anxious and nervous. Oh, man, I'm going to have this conversation. I don't know how it's going to go. God's not anxious about it. He's not worried. He knows what's going to happen. So I'm trying to believe that, God, I don't want to do this. This is difficult, but I know you're ultimately in control here, and you've called me to have this conversation. I'm going to do it, believing that. And then I've also got to remember that I need to give an account for how I live my life. And if God's calling me to confront my spouse, that means I ought to do that because I'm going to stand before him and tell him. It says in Romans 14, each of us is going to give an account to himself to God. I don't know how he's going to react to it. I don't know what she's going to think, but this is my step, and I'm going to do it. Also, you might have to pray to forgive the other person. If it's gotten to a point where you have some resentment, some bitterness in your heart toward your spouse, it would be better to pray to forgive that person before the conversation than to need that to happen in the conversation, and now things are blurred a little bit. You're not going to be as objective. You're not going to leave it to God. So if you can, forgive the person and then enter conflict so you can just bring up the things you want to bring up and trust it to the Lord. So before going into the conversation, we are praying, okay? If you're having trouble with having a source for why you should forgive this person, just remember, God in Christ Jesus has also forgiven you of the many things you've done wrong. There's an abundant source of why I ought to forgive this person, despite the fact they hurt me. All right, let's get to the good stuff here. Let's get to the conversation. So we're here now, about to have a conversation. Here's some things to think about. First of all, it ought to be face-to-face. I hear of way too many conflicts in marriage that happen over text messages, where there's an 8 or 10 text conversation that go back, and that was the conflict. They fought it out. You can't do that. It's so limited. It's been shown that writing comes off more negative than speaking face-to-face. You might think that you are writing the kindest, most gentle email that could ever be written about a confrontation. And you push that send button, your spouse reads it, and they only see this person hates me, they think I suck, they wish they weren't married to me. It's hard to communicate. You don't have any of the body language. You can't respond to what they're saying. Look them in the eye. We've got to do this face-to-face. Let's stop doing that. Have you ever noticed at the end of the Bible, there's all these really short little letters? Have you ever wondered why that is? Look at what John says at the end of 2 John. He says, I have much to write to you, but I don't want to use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to visit you and talk with you face to face so that our joy may be complete. He knew. He's like, I got more things to tell you, and you're not going to be happy, so I'm going to wait till I'm looking at you so that we can make this right. The next time you get that nasty text from your spouse, what are you going to do? Just respond. We'll talk about it later. Send. That'll make them good and mad, but at least then you can actually do conflict right, okay? Let's avoid doing this over text. If they're out of the state or something and you can't see them, at least a phone call. You can at least have conversation. That's still limited, but it's better. So let's make sure that's first. Second, you want to start with your fault in the conflict. You're having the conversation, you're sitting there looking at each other. Even if it truly is 90% their fault and only 10% your fault, you still want to start with your fault in the conversation. Jesus tells us, he says, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the huge log in your own eye? Now, he's being hyperbolic here, but the point is we're so quick to see the faults of other people. Let's start by sitting there and thinking, what did I do wrong here? Where was I wrong? What this does is this disarms the other person, and it promotes vulnerability. There will be times when I know there's going to be some conflict between me and my wife, and when I know that's coming, I got the guns blazing, I'm ready to go, I got my 5-point argument built up, I know what I'm going to say, and she'll come in and say, hey, I'm really sorry for how I treated you the other day. What am I supposed to do with that, right? It's like she just handed me a cake. You can't shoot someone when they hand you a cake. I got to put the guns away. And it disarmed me. And now I start to think, well, that's true, but you know what? I was being a real jerk too, and I'm sorry. You'll be amazed if you start trying to practice this, how good this works. And it's true because you do almost always have some kind of fault in here. Might as well start there. When you're doing this, You want to be honest, unqualified, and unconditional. What I mean by that is honest. First of all, don't apologize for things that you did not do. That's just as bad as not apologizing for things you did do. You're lying. Think about truly what I do wrong. I'm sure you'll come up with something. Be unqualified. In other words, it's not like, hey, I'm really sorry I exploded on you the other night, but if you wouldn't have come home so late, slammed the door, woke me up, that's not unqualified. You're giving all your reasons for why you were wrong. Just say it and shut your mouth. I'm sorry I did this, period. Bite your tongue, hold your breath, start counting. I don't know, do something, right? Unqualified and unconditional. It's not just, okay, I'm saying this so that you'll tell me your fault also, right? Just leave it out there. Here's what I did wrong, and I just want to say I'm sorry for it. Most of the time, that's going to begin the conflict, and it's going to be healthy. They'll respond with what they did wrong. If they don't, then you might have to help draw them out of it. But that's the way to start. Your fault. Now, this is a super practical point to think about. You want to emphasize I statements over you statements. So instead of, you were so mean to me the other day, you yelled at me too much, you did this, you did that, why not rephrase that? I felt hurt when you yelled at me the other day. I was embarrassed when you said that in front of our friends. Something like that. Again, the same thing. What you're doing here is you're moving away from accusation of their character, which promotes defensiveness, to how you were affected. When I feel like my character is attacked, I want to defend and I want to explain why I was right. But if I know that I hurt my wife in some way, I'm much less defensive and I want to change. I don't want to do that. So this is just a real simple thing to think about. A few years ago, my wife and I were hanging out with some of our friends, and she was just, you know, rolling in the way she does and making jokes, and she was just mocking me in some way that I was pretty insecure about. And she didn't know it at the time, and I felt really insecure. And we're driving home, and I said, you know, I honestly want to tell you that I felt kind of insecure when you were making fun of me. I probably shouldn't. I know we're just joking around, have fun, and I just felt like telling you that. Do you think she responded like, "You sissy? Why would you feel that way?" No. She felt bad, and she said, you know, "I'm really sorry about that. I don't want to do that. I don't want you to feel that way." And we were able to comfort each other. We prayed together. It's probably the best conflict resolution we've ever had. One of the few great stories there. It was good. It was awesome. And God really worked there because I followed this little principle here. So you ought to be thinking about that. Also, in the conversation, you're trying to aim for being clear with specific examples. Instead of things like, "You're always angry. You're always telling me what to do." When I hear things like that, my first response is like, "When? When did I ever do this?" But if I hear, "Last Tuesday you said this to me. Saturday you said this to me. Yesterday you said this to me," I'm just, "Oh, okay, I remember that. That's true, I did that." Now there's a record of wrongdoing. Again, it's similar to the last one. It's not me as a person she's attacking now. It's my actions that I've done. You see that? That's what you want to bring out of this. That, again, the defensiveness falls away when it's specific examples as opposed to just, "You are this." Don't attack the character. Attack the actions. You got to be sure that they get the point. There's nothing worse than building up all that courage. You finally go in there and have that difficult conversation, and you leave and you're not sure they understood what you're saying. Have you ever had that? That's awful. You don't want that. So at some point in the conversation, you might even say something like, "Do you understand what I'm saying? Can you repeat back to me the issue I'm trying to bring up?" If you're not sure that they get it. You want them to be able to get it in that conversation. Because it's not fun to have these conversations. Actively listen. You know, a lot of us, when we're the peace fakers, and when we finally get in there and have that confrontation, it's like, "Whew, got that off my chest, thank God." And the whole point is just to get that out of you and onto them. No, the point of the conflict is to get to truth, to resolve. And so not only are you bringing up your concerns, but you're listening to their response so that you can get to truth. Actively listening. What that means is now I'm not just listening to what they're saying, but also what are they not saying. So, you know, if I hear at some point my spouse say, "I'm really sorry," I want to know, what are they sorry for? Are they sorry that I felt sad? Are they sorry in some general way that we're having this conversation? Or are they sorry for the actions that I'm bringing up? Are they sorry for that? So we got to listen closely in this conflict. It's not just me getting this out and that's it. You should listen to the point where you are prepared to have your stance changed. You don't know all the details. You've got a hunch on something. You're seeing something. Something happened. You don't know everything yet, so be prepared to have your stance changed. Just a few weeks ago, my day to sleep in on the weekends is Sunday. Didn't happen today, but usually it's Sunday. And that means my wife gets up with the kids and I get to sleep in. And oh, I really love that day, right? That's nice. Get to sleep in a little bit. Well, a few weeks ago, Sunday morning rolls around, 6 a.m., the first kid starts crying, and I'm like, okay, she's probably going to get up in a minute here. We'll just, you know, I'm sure she's just about to get out of bed. A couple more minutes go by. She kind of gives me one of those, "Do you think you can get the kids today?" I'm like, "No, absolutely not. It's your turn." She's like, "I stayed up so late last night." That's your fault. You knew this was coming. You get the kids. We're having an argument. She's like, "Please, no, please." So finally, I go get the kids. I'm dead tired. All day long, I'm bitter toward her, you know, angry, resenting, thinking, oh, why did she do this? And again, I shouldn't have probably brought this up in conflict, but I did. At night, finally, I come up to her and I say, "You know, I was really angry that you didn't do your job this morning. It was your turn to get up with the kids." And she hadn't been harboring this, but she brought up, she said, she mentioned 5 different times the previous week where she had done my job without saying anything, without me asking, just because I was doing other things. And she named 1, 2, 3. I'm just like, okay, maybe that wasn't the worst thing that I did your job this one time. You see, my stance was changed because I didn't have all the information. I don't think I went in prepared to have my stance changed, but it changed. We ought to be willing to think, I'm seeing a certain thing, but I'm willing to be changed if I'm wrong here. You're focusing on what you can control in the conversation. You can't control how your spouse is going to react. It's going to get dirty, maybe. It's going to be tough. But you can control your own sin, what you've done before, and what you're going to do in that conversation, and you can control your challenge. It might just be, look, this is what I'm thinking. This is what I'm seeing. Take it for what it's worth. You can't control how they're going to react. Don't focus on that. Yeah, remember to find your needs are fully met in Christ when they're upset after the conversation. And then the goal is to end in prayer together. It'd be great if you could end in prayer together. A lot of times, whichever one of us, me or my spouse, initiates the prayer, the other person's pride has already been so heightened that the fact that they didn't think to do that, now they're not going to pray. Do you guys ever have that? You go ahead and pray then. At least one person's praying, I suppose. It's better than nothing. It'd be better if both people are taking this to God, getting that same perspective back that we talked about earlier. God, you're in control. We know you brought us together. We know you want us to have a good marriage. We're trusting you here. Oh, that's going to do wonders. There's sometimes where you don't have your conflict resolved. It's night, you're about to go to bed, and you just pray right there. And it's not like that finished the conflict, but at least you're going to bed with a little bit of peace of heart in your mind instead of this anger, this emptiness, this unresolved conflict. So you've got to try to pray together at the end. Now, I got one more slide here to think about the actual conversation, and it's some absolute do-nots in marriage. And I'm bringing this up because I'm a leader in the college ministry in our church, and we're seeing a lot of young marriages, and some of them are doing some of the things on this list, and you just can't do it. You're breaking the rules. It's not what we do in marriage. And I wish I had enough time to go through and say, here's the root of this, and here's why the Lord doesn't want you to do this, and here's how you can get out all those motivation. We don't have time for that. I'm just going to put this list up here, and hopefully you'll agree these are some real big do-nots. You guys are like, what on earth is it? Anticipating. What are the do-nots of marriage? Here you go. You can't say this in marriage. I regret marrying you. You're in a fight, and you throw a line like this out. You apologize for it the next day, and you think, okay, it's fine now. No. That's not going to be forgotten. That's against the rules. You can't say this. Even if sometimes you think this, hopefully you don't think it much, but if you do sometimes, you just can't say it. No, can't do it. Using the divorce word. You're losing in an argument. Here's your leverage. Well, maybe I should just divorce you. Can't do it. Got to avoid that. That's not a threat. That's not a good threat. Using insecurities against them. Things you know that they feel shameful about, and this is your way to get some points in the fight. Avoid that. It's out of bounds. Can't do it. Name calling, cussing out. You call your spouse a word that you would never imagine saying to another person. You can't say that to your spouse. Verbal or physical intimidation. I'm going to get up in their face and finger point. It's not how we do conflict in marriage. It's against the rules. Keeping silent to punish. Just refuse to say anything. You're just going to sit there. No, we have to talk this out. That's what we're doing in marriage here. And again, I realize there's probably a lot of us here that are thinking, I've done several of the things on that list there. Well, what I think at this point then, we need to get some help. We can't be doing these things. God can help us. He's got a good plan for us, but we need help here. These are things that we've really got to avoid in marriage. Post-conflict. So, what do we do after the conversation? Hopefully it's resolved, but you might need some time. Give it a few days, then ask what they've been thinking. You know, some people are just built in a way that they cannot hear it and in that moment agree. They need time. I am this way. You can ask my wife. Anytime she's brought something up with me, to today probably, I'll still be like, I don't think so. I don't think that's right. Hold my ground, and then 2 days later I'll say, you were right. And I almost always follow her. She's got good advice. Now, I should be growing in that. That's mainly my fault. But she has learned not to think, oh, this was a failure, this didn't work. She knows. I just got to give him a couple days. I put it out there. He heard it. He's going to think about it. And he'll almost always come around to what she said. That's how I am. I wish I wasn't so prideful, but that's what I do. And so she's learned that. Might have to do that sometimes. You might eventually need a third-party mediator in your marriage. Let me rephrase that. I can't imagine a marriage that never needs a third party to speak into it. How could that be true? This is the hardest thing you're going to do in your adult life is have a successful long-term marriage. We need help. I think there's way too many marriages that are too proud to ever have a third person in there and they say, here's what I'm seeing, here's what she's seeing, what do you think? Just to get some objectivity. Don't be so, some people are like, oh, it's going to look bad. Our marriage is going to look bad if we get some help. So I'm not going to do it. No, your marriage is going to continue to be bad if you don't get help. Who cares what people think? That's going to be a good example to them to be humble and need a little help. So let's be willing to get some help. I've been on both sides of this. I've helped try to stand in there for other marriages, and my wife and I have had needed people to sit in there with us as we discuss some issue we've had. I'm sure there's going to be plenty of it in the future. I get it. I know that it's difficult to do that, especially when I'm afraid they're going to side on her side. But man, we need this. Let's not be afraid to get some help. Some conflict really needs it. Finally, in really serious conflict, you might need a long battle or compromise. There are certain things that are worth having that battle for weeks, months, years. If my wife came home today and told me, no, I don't know about this God thing anymore. I don't know if he's any good. I don't want to follow him anymore. That's something I'm digging my heels in, and I'm going to fight for a long time for that. That doesn't mean every day I'm having a passionate, heated conversation about it, but I'm praying about it every day. I'm looking for my opportunities to remind her of what God's done and how good he is. I'm probably talking to her friends. She needs some help here. Can you get in there and help her? That's a long-term battle. I'm not giving up on that one. Or you might need to compromise on certain things. if you just can't see resolution together. So, that is conflict resolution in marriage 101. Hopefully you got a couple things out of there. Let's draw a couple conclusions here. First of all, again, conflict should be expected. We're going to have this, and it can be healthy when properly handled. Don't leave here thinking you have a lot of conflict, you're in bad shape. No, this is okay. Conflict should be decided, not just reacted to, and taken on in prayer. And if you're following the principles laid out, conflict can take your marriage to new heights. Your marriage can grow and grow as you learn how to resolve conflict in a healthy way.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.